Okay. So now we're going to talk about cognition and behavior. Of course, there are many more things in that area that I could cover even in a whole full course, but so let's start with action theory. I already talked about it in the first class, as I recall. So this is Don Norman's work on describing how a user confronted to a system and trying to solve a task goes through a number of steps with execution steps on one hand and evaluation steps on the other hand. And his goal here was to emphasize the fact that depending on how the system is designed, there are distances that are larger or smaller, requiring more or fewer steps or more or less mental effort. So in the execution side, you have a goal, you start from an intention of how you are going to solve this subtask. You specify a number of actions, and then you execute those actions. So the classical example is you want to delete a file. If you're in a line-oriented environment, you have to remember that you have to type the right commands with the right arguments, and then you type it. If you are in a graphical interface, you click the file and you can drag it to the trash. And so separates this execution distance in cognitive and input distance. So here you're thinking about what you're going to do, here you're doing it. And thinking about what you're going to do requires having what he calls a conceptual model, a mental model. We'll get back to this in the next class. And you were making a plan of what you're going to do. And then the input distance, and you have to perform the actual actions. And so it can be easy to think about how to do something, but it may take a long time to do it, or vice versa. So that's why he splits it in this way. And then once you've executed the action, you want to see if it did the right thing. And so there is the evaluation part, which again is subdivided into articulatory distance, going from perceiving what's on the screen to interpreting it, understanding what it means, and then the cognitive distance, which is understanding what it means and comparing with the goal you had initially to find out if it did the right thing or not. So if you're going to, again, remove a file, if you are in a line-oriented environment, the perception is you type, remove the file, and then nothing or almost nothing happens. The interpretation is that when you get the prompt back, the command has been executed. And you have to know that if there's no error, it did do what you asked it to do. But usually the evaluation is going to be another sub-goal saying, well, let me make sure it's really gone. And you'll find that 90% of users, after they remove a file, they type ls to see if it's really gone. And even expert users, right? So here, the articulatory distance is hard because you have to understand that if nothing happens, it did what it was supposed to do. But it also means that you actually perform the actions that were doing the right thing. So this is why people do the checking, is because there are many assumptions that you have to make in this whole part here to make sure that the right thing happened. Maybe you've misspelled the file name, but there was another file name by that name, and you removed the wrong file name. I mean, all these kinds of things. If you are in the graphical user interface, you drag the icon, the perception is the icon is gone. On the early Macintosh, the trash, when you went to empty to non-empty, would get bigger, so you would have a visual feedback that it contained the object, and so the interpretation was easier. And then the evaluation is that, well, as long as you trust the graphical UI to show you the real state of the system, the file is gone. And so his argument was that in graphical user interfaces, those distances tend to be smaller than in line-oriented interfaces. This is the time at which this thing was developed, this transition from line-oriented interfaces to graphical user interfaces. Now, whether that is a theory or not is a good question. I wouldn't call it a theory, because I don't know how to falsify it. I mean, we have a diagram with boxes, I can explain, it makes sense, but I don't... It hasn't been tested with a scientific method. So, I'm going to have to speed up a bit, because I tend to... talk a little bit too much on all these things. Anyway, so let's move to things that I find more interesting or relevant, or just that I like more. So situated action. So there is it's not called a, she doesn't call it a theory, so I won't call it a theory. So this was introduced by Lucy Suchman in her PhD thesis. Lucy Suchman is an anthropologist, so she was trained as an anthropologist who, you know, they go out and study people by observation in general. And she was studying, she was working at Xerox, and so she was studying people using photocopiers. And so at the time, cognitivism was really, you know, rising as the major approach to everything that had to do with the human behavior. And in particular, there was this notion that existed even before cognitivism that, you know, humans and also animals, when we solve a problem, we, and that's what we see in Norman's action theory. We formulate a plan, and then we execute the plan, and then we look if it worked or not. If it did, we move on to the next task or goal, and if not, we try to fix it. And what she observes is that things are a lot more complicated than that. And so what she did is a very detailed analysis of the work practices and looking at the causal chains of events that she could infer from the observations that she was making. So, you know, she's looking at a photocopier and people coming and going. And things go wrong all the time. And you've used photocopiers, right? So you arrive and the thing is jammed, or there's no paper, or you can't figure out how to do the scaling or the double side or whatever. And what you observed is that what humans do is what she called situated action. They don't have plans. They adapt to the situation. And so human action takes place not in this ideal world where, you know, you have a problem, you close your eye, you have a problem, you solve the problem in your head, and then you just do it, and then, you know, it works, it doesn't work, and you start over again. Things are a lot more fluid. And there may be plans when people have, you know, I can ask you to you know, describe to me how you go from here to Building 650 on campus, and then you have a plan to this. But if you go out and there is construction or it's raining or something, you will fluidly adapt the plan. It's not like you will always execute the plan that you had and see that it fails. You will adapt it as it goes. And so the notion of situated action is that action just to the context. And because it takes place in that context and is part of it, your actions also modify the context for your future actions or others' future actions. So something that I have observed in my lab with the printer is what happens when the printer is out of paper. And you know, when you go to the printer, you don't start planning, okay, what am I going to do if it's out of paper? You arrive there, your thing is not out, so oh, what's going on? And you realize, oh, there's no paper. And then, you know, you realize on the spot, well, I'm going to be nice and I have some time, so I will put paper in. Or, well, I'm in a hurry or don't really need that printout, and so I'll pick it up later when someone else has put paper in. And one thing I've observed in the building we were before is that the behavior, the overall behavior, changed according to how many people use the printers. So if you have a few people using the printer, you tend to fix it when it's broken. But when you have more people, if it's broken, you say, well, someone else will do it. So, you know, all these things are a lot more subtle, complex, and I think what Lucy Suchman introduced is really this notion of situatedness, which in a sense you can draw a link to Gibson's theory that says, you know, this is not about just the animal, it's the coevolution and the adaptation to the environment and vice versa. And I think this is the same thing at a much different time scale, because here it happens in seconds or minutes. This constant adaptation to plan. You know, we arrived this morning, the door was locked. It so happened that I was chatting with a colleague in the corridor. Her door was locked as well, so she went to the person who has the keys and had had her open the door. And I didn't think that my door could be locked. We were chatting. So I arrived here, the door is locked. I say, oh, well, I know where to find the person who has the key. Because I don't teach here often, so I don't know the people, etc. If there hasn't been this event before, and I ran into most of you, I think, in the corridors, so I told you, get there and I'll be back with the key, because I knew where to get the key. If not, I don't know. Maybe I would have said, well, I don't know where to find the key, let's go to building 650, because I know I can find a room there. So, you know, all these things sort of happen on the spot and according to the context. And probably I would have said something different if it were pouring rain. Or so all of this is important. And this is what really this ethno-methodological approach is about, is really looking at all the details. And they are really, you know, I was talking about models and abstractions. So anthropologists are really careful with that. I don't say they are against that, but they are really careful before they generalize things, and because they don't like losing the details, because they know that a lot of important things are in the details. And so we were having a little discussion the other day about task models. I see another typo here that we'll fix. One thing that I find a little bit dangerous with approaches that are based on what's called task analysis and task models, and we'll talk a little bit about it when we talk about conceptual design next time, is that usually they are based on this assumption that you can describe human activities in little boxes and trees, and you do this and you do that and then you do this, and that people will conform to this. Wendy Mackay has done studies in air traffic control, and she looked at how controllers work. And so the thing is that if you ask the people, the controller's boss, how they are supposed to work, it will give you a book that says, you know, everything they're supposed to do, that all these procedures for what you're supposed to do. If you observe them in the room, they don't do that at all. In fact, if they were applying the rules in the book, they wouldn't be able to have half the planes in the air because there are so many rules and etc. So they constantly adapt. They adjust. If the traffic is heavy, you know, they can act in a certain way. When the traffic is light, it's different. And so I think, you know, task analysis and all that can be a useful part of the process, but don't think that people conform according to, you know, what the task analysis says, or what the other types of approaches that are really considering that, you know, humans are like computers and are running a program that always does the same thing. And so in that same vein of looking at things at the same time at the more global level, more system level, and also looking at the detail, and there's another approach called activity theory that really comes from Russian psychologists, Vygotsky and Leontief. So Vygotsky was conducting analysis of human activity, and his description of it was that a lot of human activity can be considered as relationship between subjects and objects, those who do and things that they do, and that these relationships are mediated by what you call tools or technical instruments, things like, you know, pens and from pens to the writing press, to the printing press, sorry, from tools you use for cooking to tools you use for manufacturing things, or what you call science, psychological instruments, which is everything that goes with language and how you can control people through language. And then Leontief developed that further and added an emphasis on the community. And, I mean, remember, these are Russian psychologists. This was, I believe, in the maybe 60s, 70s. So, the Russian, I mean, the USSR was still in full swing. And so Leontief was looking at the role of community and how people organize work, and so the notion of division of labor, the notion of rules and rituals that emerge so that people can organize their work. So it's a pretty I wouldn't say necessarily complex, but it is not easy to read those authors. And Susanna Butker, who's as you may guess from Scandinavia, she's from Denmark, took these theories and looked at them in the context of human-computer interaction. And again, in her PhD thesis that is called Through the Interface, she used those tools to analyze and design interactive systems. This was also at a time where in Europe, and particularly in Northern Europe, in Scandinavia, there was starting to be a strong shift in various countries with the growing role of computers in every areas of activity, and in particular economical activity. And so what happened in Scandinavia is that the unions were very active. And they were not against the computerization of tasks, but they said, you know, we want to be part of the process that puts computers in everybody's office or work. And there's a famous case of newspaper moving from the traditional process where you had journalists writing things
by hand or a typewriter, handing it off to copyists who would copy edit, handing it off to typographers that would do the layout, and then the printers print it. So the move from this type of organization of a news organization into one that used computers, where essentially the journalist can type his article in a layout system. You don't really need a copy editor, and you don't need a typographer, and you just go to print almost. I mean, there is some layout to do, but. And of course, the union saw the danger of having a lot of jobs being made redundant. And in France, they would go on strike. And in Scandinavia, they said, well, okay, we want to be involved in this. And so this gave rise to something called participatory design, which is an approach to designing systems where you involve the users in the process of building the new system. Not things like focus groups where you interview the some users before and then you go off, you build your system and you come back 2 years later. It was really participatory so that they would be part of the process. And so a lot of work in Scandinavia that is about human-computer interaction is really in the context of this participatory design approach. And the notions of activity theory. So if you take, and I'm sure you will all take the CEI course, the Design and Evaluation of Interactive Systems, where you will apply the participatory design approach. And so you will see all this process. Getting back to activity theory here, What Vygotsky introduces is the notion that you have a sort of higher level that he calls activity that is something that responds to a need. So putting out a new issue of a newspaper, to stay with this example, or, editing the report for my project. And then these get broken down into actions that are, identified entities that you execute consciously to reach the explicit goal. So it's not that different from the task description, but it's less strict than what you have in a task description. And then there's the operations, the things you execute unconsciously, I hope, not really, but semi-consciously to execute the actions. So, when you're typing on a keyboard, unless you're really not a touch typist, you're not thinking about, where is every key. It becomes sort of an action. Same thing with pointing. You don't think that you're pointing. It becomes sort of subconscious. And here, there's something very interesting in that some actions can become operations and some operations can become actions. And I think it's a very interesting level of analysis of when you look at using a computer. So when an action becomes an operation, it's when you have sort of something that becomes automatic. They call it internalization. And you can see it's... I like that better than people who talk about novice versus expert. We use this distinction... on the last class, we were talking about experiments. I think this is a much better way to look at it, saying, if you're an expert, you have internalized a number of things that you do without thinking. But, and that's why I think this is better to look at it, an operation can become an action. So something that is done subconsciously without thinking suddenly pops up, and this is oftentimes in case of a failure. So something that works, usually you don't even think about it, someday doesn't work. The other day I had my laptop open, and at home I have a screen and the keyboard. And so I had the laptop open, and I start typing in the keyboard. It took me, it sounded like 2 minutes, but it was probably 10 seconds before realizing it was not working. I was really confused. took me a while to say, oh, but you know, I hadn't plugged in the thing into the screen, and so the keyboard was not active. So in case of failure, things become conscious again, and you are able to reflect on it and all that. And then activity can become an operation. Again, when things become repetitive, you can have these transitions between levels. And that's one of the things I like about this theory, is that it has this explicit room for things changing status over time.
I'm sorry, I keep fixing the typos as I go, because otherwise I will not get to it. There was one here too.
Okay, and here's the diagram that you see in many papers talking about activity theory. So this is what I was talking about before. The subject-object relationship is mediated by tools. So the subject is going to act onto an object using an instrument. And then there's the part that adds the community. So in a sense, the community mediates the relationship between subject and object by deciding who is supposed to do what. And it does that through two things. One is rules. So for example, you know, you have a particular job, so it means you're supposed to do this type of things. And the other is the division of labor, when well, you have a bunch of people who are copyeditors and you assign them to specific tasks. There are other ways to talk about rules and division of labor. And so you get this nice figure, and there is a paper where they take this figure, they take the three corners here, and they put them together, and they say that, you know, instruments, rules, and division of labors. I mean, in a sense, rules and division of labor are also instruments to mediate the role of the community. And so it's a nice little construction there. Now, another thing I find interesting in the literature is something a lot less ambitious, I would say, but that I find is an interesting way to look at interactive systems. So this is work by Thomas Green, who's a British psychologist. And one of the things he worked on a lot was the psychology of programming. So looking at the activity of writing computer code, creating programs for the computer, from the perspective of the psychologist. When you write programs, you manipulate abstractions and concepts, but at the same time you manipulate a concrete notation, which is the syntax of your language. And so he's been looking at what are the problems that you run into when you have these concepts of programming languages, the actual syntax of the language, and the actual application you're trying to build. And then, so he defined the systems that he called cognitive dimensions, which is, again, he's not pretending to do a theory, he's calling it, in fact, a notation, a tool that is designed to help designers to evaluate a system or set of possible designs according to a set of criteria. And this is all centered around this notion of representation, is that, you know, we often work with abstractions and representations, with concepts and concrete representations of these concepts. And this is particularly true with computers. And so what he found is that when you look at people who do work on a computer, they're activities can be sort of analyzed in terms of six broad categories.
Most of their activity can fit into one of these. One is, let's start with transcription, where you have data in one form and you need to transcribe, copy it into another form. It can be from paper to a computer where you type things in. It can be that you have something in one document format and then you need to put it into a document format, etc. So, transcription of information. Another one is incrementation, where you add something to an existing document, program, spreadsheet, whatever. There's modification, where you change things. And adding and changing is different, because to change, you need to really understand what it is you're changing. To add, you don't necessarily need to know much about the part that is already there. Exploration. So that's when you have a more active role, where you try to find a solution. You don't know how to get there, and so you go there through trial and error. Search is a very important activity. Spend a lot of time looking for things. You know they are there, and it's often hard to get there, to find it. And what you call it's comprehension, discover an unknown aspect of the system. Now, the reason why it's interesting to look at these activities is that you can imagine that a number of solutions for each of these activity can be translated from one system to another system. So once you analyze things in these things, it has a generative power. It helps you to say, oh, this is transcription. Maybe I can do it like I've done it in that other system. But then it gets to really what allows you to analyze and compare systems and solutions is those dimensions. So this is the definition, aspects of the informational structure that can be analyzed according to the activity being studied. So informational structure is a generic term that, it can be a program, it can be the shape of the user interface, the buttons, the dialog box, it can be the content of the document. So it's the thing you're working with. It's what I've called object of interest before. And so here are properties that you find in a number of systems and that usually cause problems. So one is viscosity. I really like this one because we see it often. Viscosity is resistance to change. You know, if you have a pot of honey, it's very hard to move a spoon in a pot of honey. There is resistance to change, but if it's water, it's a lot more fluid. So, and you see that in systems a lot, where you've done something and changing is, something that is conceptually simple will take a lot of effort to change. Changing sometimes the formatting of text, things are... and the problem is that when something is hard to change, people don't change it. They prefer to deal with a less good solution than taking all the steps it takes to change it. Another problem that we see often is visibility, the ability to see what you need to see to do your work. So this has to do with search and with navigation that we'll talk about later. So I'm not going to go through all of them. Premature commitment is also one that I'm sure you've encountered. It's the constraints on the order of actions. So one good example is there are many systems where before you start doing something, it asks you, well, what is going to be the name of this? For example, I start typing a file, I have an idea, I want to write a piece of a paper or an idea for an experiment, something. I type, I save. First save, it tells me, what name? And I don't know, I don't care, I don't want to tell you now. I want to not lose my work, that's why I'm saving, and I want to continue working. So
Pre-measured commitment is asking me to do things at the time where, you know, I don't want to do it. So hidden dependencies, so it speaks for itself. Links between things you don't realize are there and then cause problem because they're not visible or you don't see them. Role expressiveness is, I don't think I have time to go into it. And one that we find in many, many ergonomics rules and other design principles for interfaces is consistency. Similar semantics are expressed with similar syntax, and vice versa. Things that have similar syntax or look the same should also work the same. And the reason for this, of course, is about how learning, the way we learn, and the fact that the more we are encountering the same situations and the more the same actions lead to the same results, the easier it comes. It links back to action theory and the fact that actions become operations if you encounter them again and again. So consistency encourages that. So this is not the whole list, and there are a number. So this is a useful tool to analyze it, interfaces, and it is also generative in that I can say, okay, where do I have primitive commitment, and then how do I solve it? You know, for the file example, I could save in a temporary file, just because I know that if I saved before giving a name, it's just because I don't want to lose the work. But then the next question should be, well, why would I have to save? Right? When can the computer save the file for me? Even before I've done the first save? I mean, I know Office, for example, does backups. Although it does it in a very intrusive way, because I'm backing up. So I'm doing these slides, I'm in the middle of things, and it pops a dialog box, oh, backing up, stop. This is insane. This is, you know, I'm not sure it's in the list here, but this notion of interrupting the user. So the saving on the hard drive should happen in the background. Well, there are more and more tools that do this today, but it has taken a long time to get there. Things as basic as this. Okay, so that's it for what I will talk about in terms of cognitive models. As I said, this is really my selection of things I like. But just to give you a sample of what you can find in that area. Now I want to turn to interaction. So models that were created by people working in human-computer interaction and to solve problems with the design of interactive systems. All the things we've seen before come from other disciplines, even though for activity theory and situated action, they were quite linked with computer interfaces. As I said, Lucy Suchman is still, she's still alive and active, an anthropologist, and for activity theory, Susan Abadker really brought to the field something that came from psychology. So again, here's a sample of various models, and I don't think there's much of a theory in that list. For human-computer interaction. So, a work that is quite ancient now, that was done in the 80s, is the morphological analysis of input devices by Carl McKinley Robertson, who were three researchers from Xerox PARC. They all left now. Robertson went to Microsoft. Jack McKinley created a startup company that does visualization, and Stuttgart retired from Xerox PARC and is now spending some time at Stanford. So what they were looking at is having a model to describe input devices. That was at the time where the mouse had become like the input device, but there were still a lot of questions of how can we do 2D input in particular with other devices like joysticks and touch screens and all that. And so they wanted to have a way to describe this whole devices in a generic way. So they come up with this model to describe an input device as the combination of these different properties, the manipulation operation, what it is that the user has to do physically to manipulate the device. Is it moving an object like the mouse? Is it applying force like on a joystick? Is it, what is the direction of motion? Is it linear, circular? Are the movements, are the information captured in an absolute or relative way? A mouse is relative. It only sends information when you move it, when you change. But a tablet, for example, or a touchscreen is absolute. It tells you where you... And so this makes big differences, because with a mouse, for example, you can change the gain of the mouse because it's relative. But with a touchscreen, you touch where you touch, so you don't have... So the input domain is the range of values, the state of the device, very interesting here, the resolution function, how do you map input to output, very important for things like all these input 2D devices. So the output domain is the values you have in output, and then, if you have something interesting you want to say, you put it in other properties. And for them, a device could be very simple, like one button of a mouse. And so then they had operators to compose those input devices, operations like merging, layout, and connect. I'm not going to go into details. They consider that the fact that the mouse sends X and Y, you're merging something that senses X and something that senses Y. I'm not sure you would do it this way today. At the time, the mice were using a ball, and they had an X sensor and a Y sensor. The mice today are optical, so they don't separate X and Y. They give you a vector. Then the layout is something that says, well, I'll take those three buttons and I put them on the mouse, so it's really a physical position. And then connect, here they consider that the cursor is in fact part of the mouse, and you connect the position of the cursor to the output of the mouse itself. And it's not the layout because they're separate. So, I'm going to skip this slide to go directly to this large table that they published, where they were looking at a visualization for all these devices. So the idea here is that you have devices that use linear motion, such as the mouse, and devices that use rotary motion, such as if you have a radio and you turn dials. And, do you have X, Y, Z? So on the mouse you have X and Y, and they are, we saw, merged together, so that was this line here. But the button is only sensing Z values, so the button is here, linear in Z position, and the little dot says that there are three buttons that are attached to the mouse. So that describes the mouse. The lines here, are you sensing position, movement? So position is absolute, movement is relative. And do you sense force or change in force? That's what they had in that initial diagram. And so what they did is look at a bunch of devices, right? Tablet, light pen, touch panel, touch screen, different cursors. Polyhemus Cube was a 3D tracker. Treadmill is something you walk on. Trackball, velocity joystick, isometric joystick where you it senses the force. The joystick doesn't move, but etc. And so what you see is that what's interesting with this type of things is it shows you, you know, how is this space populated? So one thing I see immediately, there's nothing that senses a change in force or a change in rotary force, which is called torque. Mm-hmm. There are relatively few that sense force. Quite a bit that are relative in motion. So essentially everything that looks like a mouse. And then there's a lot that just sense absolute position. That's not too surprising because you're trying to control the position on the screen with the cursor in general. So having direct mapping absolute to position makes sense. What is interesting is that there's a lot of rotary controllers, maybe more than you may have expected. And of course, it's the XY absolute input devices that have the most samples here. So when we do this kind of things, we usually call that a design space. We identify a number of dimensions, and we classify things in this multidimensional space. And what we try to look is for places in that space that haven't been explored yet, and see if it makes sense to go there. So this is a generative value of this kind of approach. Here it's applied to input devices, but you'll find it in a number of other areas. When people look at tangible interaction or other forms of interaction, they usually, people do some initial experiments, they try something, they come up with some ideas, and then someone comes and say, well, let's try to organize this and see what it is we've explored and what is left to explore by doing this design space and trying to analyze it in this way. So that's why I wanted to show this example, which is an early one and one that is easy to understand. And I think it's really important to do this kind of taxonomies in the design spaces to track the evolution of the inventions that we do in this field. The second thing I want to talk a little bit about is a notation, and that's called the user action notation. So, again, in the 80s, there was this transition from command-based interfaces to graphical interfaces. And for command-based interfaces, we have lots of tools to describe the syntax of the commands. And these were developed because of programming languages. I'm sure you're familiar with the diagrams that describe the syntax of a programming language. You say you have to write class and then an identifier and then a brace, etc. And of course, this type of syntax can be used for command language. So when you look at the manual for Unix or Linux command, it tells you it's called the name of the command, and then between square brackets, it's options and this and that. So there were a lot of ways to denote text-based input. But then when we moved to graphical input, people say, well, you click there, and then you drag, and you do this, and you do that. But there was no simple syntax for describing it. So user action notation is just a notation, doesn't pretend to do anything big and magic, but a very simple notation to describe the typical actions you do on a graphical user interface. And it's something where, for example, the tilde here means I'm moving the mouse
on an object that is an icon, and then I use the mouse button, that's what the M is about, and the V and the caret here represent pushing down and releasing the button. So it's trying to be a little bit visual. The tilde is supposed to evoke the fact that you're moving the object, and the little arrows here and the clicks. And then you can describe also the feedback, because in a line-oriented interface, you type a command and then nothing happens until you hit return. But of course, in a graphical interface, you have feedback. So here, the feedback is that if you click on an icon, it will highlight. So highlight means exclamation mark means highlight. And the thing is that you can describe actions with different levels of detail. So in fact, a more accurate version of this is that you move the cursor to the icon and then you press the button. And here, if there was a selected icon, it becomes unselected. And this icon you're on becomes selected. And when you release the button, nothing really happens. So it's just to show that it's a notation that you can adapt to things and look at various levels of details. So this is a similar thing for dragging an object. So here you can say I'm moving the cursor to the file icon, I click the button. Now I'm going to move from position I call XY to another one I call X prime, Y prime. So that's what it says. I can have feedback expressions here, and then I release the button, and then I can, with this expression, explain that the icon will move to the new position. So this was done at a time where, when you click and drag an icon, the icon itself didn't move. You just have a little outline of the icon, a little square, and the image of the icon would only move at the end because the computers were not fast enough. So, there's not much more to say. It's just to, the fact that when you deal with interaction that is graphical or even physical, like in tangible interfaces, where the fact that, you know, two objects get close to each other may have a meaning and things like this. It's useful to find a notation that you can use to describe those actions, to describe the behavior of the system, so you can talk about things. And they don't have to be formal notations or complex notations, but just something that works for you. And the state machines that some of you have used in TA section of the class, they are also a notation to describe interaction. Now the advantage, or the big difference at least with what we just saw, is that with state machines you have an executable description. So if I draw this with a little bit of training, I can read it and understand it quickly. So I press the button, it highlights the icon. If I release immediately, I select the icon, it's just a single click. If I start moving, I go here. There is a guard here, so in fact, I will go there only if I have moved enough. If I don't move enough, by default, I stay here. So if I start moving, I go here. I'm starting to drag. As I move more, I drag the icon. When I release, I go back up. So I'm sure you've seen that using swing states. So the advantage of this, the disadvantage of this compared to what we just saw is that it requires a bit of training to understand what it is and what it does. The advantage, of course, is that it is executable, and you can also use it to prove properties. In particular, in general, you want state machines that are reinitializable, so from any state, they should be a path back to the initial state. because the initial state is sort of the default state of the interface. And so you always want to be able to get back to the initial state. You can also look at, you know, what are the possible errors and things like this. So these are the simplest form of state machines. There are, David Harrell created state charts where you have hierarchical state machines. You can have a state machine inside another state machine. In one state, you can have a state machine. And so when you get to that state, it starts the state machine inside. And when this one is done, you get back to the parent. So it gets complicated. And PetriNets can also be used to describe interactions. So Philippe Palanque and Rémi Bastide in Toulouse have done a lot of work on PetriNets. So this is a model for interaction, but that also has a link to implementation. One problem with this is that it's really focused on input. All the output, the feedback, is captured in the actions here. But because I don't have a formal description, it's very hard to make proof that, for example, any icon that I highlight can be unhighlighted at some point, for example. Because these are in the actions and they're not formalized. Okay, now we get to a big one.
GOMS.
So GOMS is a family of model that were initially developed by CARD, the same CARD as we saw before. Tom Moran, who was also at Park and then later moved to IBM, and is still there actually, and Alan Newell, who was British researcher. And unfortunately, is not with us anymore. So, GOMS stands for Goals, Operators, Methods, Selection Rules. So here the idea is to describe the activity of the user in a way that is not unlike the underlying model of action theory. So you have a goal. Then to reach that goal, you have a number of methods that are available to you. Each method is a succession of individual operators. And then, since you have different methods to reach the same goal, there are selection rules that allow you to pick one of these methods. So, GOMS was designed both to be descriptive and predictive. I don't think it was ever designed to be generative. So descriptive, the idea was to be able to describe user tasks. And so it has a notation that we'll see in a moment where I can describe the sequence of operators, then make up a method, and all that. It's predictive because once I've broken things down into operators that are physical actions, like pointing and clicking, etc., I can assign times to each of these and then have a prediction for the complete method and compare, for example, different methods. So there are really task analysis techniques based on models of information processing. So that's the link with the theory. The underlying theory behind GOMS is that the human, humans and the human brain in particular, are information processors. We process information in a way similar to a computer, but that they don't necessarily say could be reduced to a computer. And so we'll see how that plays out. So here's a very simple example where I want to move a sentence inside a text, a piece of text, and to take a sentence, move it somewhere else. And I have the basic operators, moving the mouse, clicking the mouse button, entering a key on the keyboard.
So if I want to move the sentence in the text, I have different methods here. One could be, I delete the sentence and then retype it again. I'm sure you've done that if it's a short sentence. I could cut and paste, which means first selecting the sentence, then cutting it, then moving to the destination and pasting them. And I can do this cut-paste using keyboard shortcuts, or menu items. So I have three methods for editing. In all three methods, you need to select the sentence. And so to select, I can do it with click and drag the text. I can also double-click on the first word, and usually that will put you into word selection mode. So then you go to the last word, and if you shift-click, it will select until then. You could imagine other selection methods. And then comes the selection rules. Well, how are you going to choose between the first three rules? If the sentence is short, I'm likely to do the first one. If I know the keyboard shortcuts, I'm likely to prefer the second to the third one. Although, it may be not that clear, because if I need to use the keyboard and the mouse, I have the time. It takes time to move from one for the other. So another selection rule would be to use, the method according to where my hand is at the end of the previous task. But anyway, I've taken this selection rule here. For selection, there's also a selection rule. I'm not going into all the details. So in the original GOMS, there was a low-level model called the KLM, keystroke level model, with six operators. So hitting a key or a button of the mouse, pointing a target on the screen, homing, what I was just talking about, moving your hand from keyboard to mouse, drawing a line segment, because they were looking at some drawing tasks, and the magic operator M, mental activity, which is the mental activity to prepare for the next action. And they had time estimates for all of these. Interestingly, the pointing one, they put 1.10 seconds. They could have used Fitzlaw to have something more refined, but it was decided to use this approximation. And I love the mental activity because it's 1.35 seconds. Well, this didn't come out of the blue. They did studies and they were looking at, and it's true that you do pause before you do the next action. But what they realized is that people were also merging things together. And again, this has to do with this notion of action versus operation in action theory, where, things like selecting a piece of text, it's really moving the cursor to the beginning of the text and clicking and then dragging to the end of the text and then releasing. When you do it the first time, or the first few times, you're probably going to have a mental activity at the beginning, where is it I'm starting, and then at the end, am I really where I want to stop? But progressively, these things will get sort of merged into a single operation, and the mental activity will occur only once at the beginning. And so they had a set of rules for placing this M operator, where in the first phase you would put a lot of M's, and then you had rules to remove a number of them. So if I look at the method 5 and then 3 of my previous thing, so I'm selecting, so I'm moving the mouse, then I point and click, and then mental activity, then I point and click to the beginning, point and click at the end. Copy command, I have mental activity. Oh, I need to do a copy now. So, again, 2 point-and-clicks to go to the menu bar and then to the menu. Then I have to select the destination. So, again, mental activity, where is it I want to paste? I move and point-and-click the destination. And then the paste command, which is a menu command, so the same sequence as there. So the prediction here would be 15 seconds, which seems to me a little bit over kill. But
then I have to also draw a line between the steps for selection with the mouse.
Well, drawing line was really when you were trying to draw, to make a drawing. So it's so not dragging. It's not when you click and drag. It's really when you draw a line. And this is because they were interested in some text editing tasks and some drawing tasks. So. So this model was evolved over the years and refined. In the keystroke level model, they added some additional operators. And in the beginning, everything was done by hand, and they created a tool that helped to automatically evaluate the times and automatically evaluate the selection rules. So you could do predictions for a lot more tasks. Because it had computer support, it was a lot easier to compare various techniques. And in particular, one thing you could do is you look at all the possible methods, you time them all. You look at the ones that would be selected according to the rules you have, and you can see and you could check in a variety of scenarios whether the selection rules would select the fastest solution. Because in fact, what you observe is people are very good at optimizing for time. So for example, if you're in the example I was showing before, you could show that the selection for moving the cursor with the mouse versus the keyboard, no, it's actually not the example really I had there, but when you are moving the cursor, you can either click or you can use the keyboard, the arrow keys. And you know, spontaneously, you know that if you're moving a few characters or a couple of lines, you're going to do it with the arrow keys. And if you're moving far away, you're going to move to the mouse. And you could show exactly the value, the distance threshold where it's worth switching to the mouse. And observe that people, in fact, do it when it is indeed optimal, more or less. The problem, however, and we saw that in this little example, is that there is a tendency of their model to overestimate the execution times. Probably because their rules still leave too many M operators. And it doesn't take into account learning and the fact that if you repeat things, you will. And that would be that hard to do because learning curves are well known. I mean, reverse exponential. So now the most advanced version of that is called the CPM GOMS, critical path method, by Bonnie John, who's been really probably the person who's worked the most on GOMS. She's at CMU, and it's really taking this model of the human processor, the brain as an information processor, that is able to process perceptual, cognitive, and motor activities in parallel. So you absorb information through your senses, you process it, and then you produce motor control as output. And so she's built this really elaborate system where you can describe those tasks like the one we were talking about, but at a much more detailed level. Like, you know, to point, you need perceptual activity to see where you are, where you want to go. You need cognitive planning to plan the motion, and then you need the motor activity to do the moving of the cursor, and then adapt with where the cursor moves. And so she can create these diagrams here, where you have vision tasks, cognition tasks, right hand, left hand, which is not used here, eye movement, because it also takes time to move the eyes, and things that are happening in the world, which sometimes slow you down if you wait for the system to display something. And so what she does is that this is really a PERT diagram. You know what a PERT diagram is? So diagram you where you have tasks. Each task has a certain time, and they have time dependencies. I cannot do this before this is finished. So for example, you cannot move to the next thing before you have perceived where your cursor is. This kind of thing. And so by entering all of this in this complex system, really, they are able to make predictions that are really pretty good. If you look here, the model is the line here with the black triangles, and they tested the many subjects, but they're showing two subjects here, S1, S2, and you see that it's really close to the prediction. So what this is horizontally is the different steps. This was the different task, is using an ATM machine to get money, so entering a code and the punching buttons and things like this. So it has a pretty accurate performance prediction, and by looking at what's called the critical path, that is the path that is the one constraining the overall time, you can learn things about how to optimize the methods, the interaction methods. The problem is that doing this for something as simple as pointing an icon or doing the ATM task takes days and days. So I think as a research thing, it's very interesting and important. It's not the method that you would use for analyzing any real-life interface. But it shows that we can explain, or we have reasonable models for going to the basic human activity, perception, cognition, to what we observe at a high level in terms of performance. Okay. So, instrumental interaction, I think, was the last in the list, and since I already told you about it for a long time at a time, I don't have anything to say here more. The idea was to describe interfaces in terms of this mediated interaction. The one thing I want to add here is that it also links at this activity theory from the Russian psychologist and from Susanna Butker, in that there's a role, the mediating role of the instrument. So that's the sort of theoretical underpinning of that model, if you want. And remind you that I showed the descriptive aspect, the predictive aspect, not really predictive in terms of predicting time, but in terms of helping evaluate and compare. And we saw in GOMS how the main application is to compare different methods between them. You can do it with prediction of the time it takes to complete a task. Here I had other properties to compare things together. We could also look at performance as another way to compare instruments. And then the generative aspect, which I've shown in other models that I've talked about today, and in the case of instrumental interaction, it's through the design principles that we can help imagine new solutions to existing problems. So that was the last section here on software architecture models, and I think I'll do this quickly on Monday, the beginning of the class. I'm not going to spend much time on it. It would be the sort of a bit that would go with the course on toolkits. But I thought it was interesting to put it in that course to cover the human side, the interaction side, and the computer side. So we'll look into this thing, and especially MVC, a little bit on Monday. You have any question? No? Okay. Well, so I'll see you.